everybody. Welcome to the Alexi Sell podcast number 19. Now, our last podcast with Saul Williams, I think, was probably the least listened to podcast ever. Saul Williams, the dancer, choreographer, musician, talking about his esoteric non-linear movie about coltan mining. I thought it was fascinating and amazing conversation. But it turns out that I think my listeners like either me being shitty about Keir Starmer or the Neolithic age of comedy. So in a desperate attempt to claw back some listeners, I am this week with Lisa Mayer, the co-writer of The Young Ones. Yes, The Young Ones, Young Ones, Young Ones. Get in there, all you comedy nerds. Listen to my podcast, please. And Lisa Mayer, co-writer of The Young Ones. And I think we're going to claw back, not get quite up to Jeremy Corbyn levels, but, you know.
You never know. It might be more. Especially as you started out by calling me a Neanderthal, I suppose.
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was people who are interested in the
Neolithic
period of alternative comedy. So
now lots of people are going to write in and say, actually, Neanderthals didn't live in the Neolithic era. They were pre-Neolithic in the period.
Yeah. I don't care.
No. That's tingling. You really don't care, do you?
No.
That's your defining feature.
It is. I could have, if I'd been a 30s comedian, I could have had that on my card. Alexi Sale, he doesn't care. Fuck you. So, Lisa, anyway, would you like to talk a bit about the genesis of The Young Ones, really, seeing as you and I think Rick Mayo came up with the idea? Or
The genesis of The Young Ones was twofold. One, that we had recently been students and therefore were very steeped in the memories of being students. And the other was that the comic strip had just started and Rick had a character called Rick.
You don't get this kind of comedy these days.
The big innovation was that his character, Rick, was spelt differently from his name.
Right.
And I think maybe he always distinguished in his mind between
his comic persona.
His comic persona. Yeah. And him by putting a C in the name of his comic persona.
Right.
And
his comic persona, he personally had the more pretentious spelling of his name, whereas his comic persona had the more, but anyway.
Apparently that stemmed from when he was a kid and was a fan of Eric the Viking. He took the C out.
Okay.
But it was a bit...
he took something out. Oh.
It was a bit like those girls who used to have names that ended in I and put a little heart over the I.
Yeah. Anyway, I could go back. The first time I met you was actually at the old comedy store, which was in a strip club,
wasn't it?
And I think several things about you, that you were fabulous. You also always had a full pack of fags. And I remember you had little pixie boots, which people were wearing then. And I was reading this book called David Mayer is a Mother. And you said, that's my dad's name. I think that's the first thing you said to me. But we very soon, me, you and Rick became very close friends, didn't we?
Yeah, well, what I remember about you is that there was one very tiny dressing room with one very tiny sink.
Yeah.
And no one was allowed to use the sink because you used to come and fill it with ice and then put your drink in.
My lager. And the reason for that was that Paul Raymond used to, this was late, this was at the comic strip day. You've got to.
Oh, yes, you're right.
They're going to see all kinds of discrepancies.
Oh, the letters that were
I don't think people write letters anymore. But this was the comic strip. Because Paul Raymond used to charge us for drinks, and so I used to buy 6 cup-price lagers at supermarket, and then, yes, I used to put them in the sink with ice.
So no one could wash their makeup.
Yeah, Dawn and Jennifer. Well, it was Dawn and Jennifer's dressing room. It was the girls' dressing room.
No, they were next door.
No, I'm sure.
And also they were later.
No, they were at the comic strip. You see, you're getting everything
wrong.
Oh, you're right. They did come later.
Yeah. the later era of the comics.
I think people are going to be yearning for Saul Williams at this rate.
Yeah, I agree. Thank so God, anyway. Thank God for editors. No, you went back to when we'd first met.
Oh, I did. That's true, yeah.
Anyway, Paul Jackson, who was a young producer who was known for the two Ronnies, and who had heard that there were interesting things happening in comedy and had come down to see it, and did a program called Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, which was various people from the Comedy Store and the comic strip doing their acts on a TV program.
Yeah.
And then because it was on the BBC at the time, it was so heavily edited that virtually nothing of the original comedy remained. And so Rick and I were talking about this and saying, you know, what should be on television. There are a few things which are meant to be on television. One, you know, like a nature documentary and a sitcom, you know, and the form is a TV form. And so we were talking about his character, Rick, who was an angry poet, and what he would have been like as a student and the students that we knew who used to label their yogurts in the fridge and everything. And from that, it turned into the idea of doing a bunch of students in a flat. But because we were writing the parts for people that we knew who were at the, by then, the comic strip, we, and they were two double acts and you, Alexi, the compere, that's why we had four male students and the landlord.
Right. So you wrote and you, so you.
So we told Paul our idea.
Yeah.
And he went, great, I can get you 300 quid to write a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote the pilot. And while Rick and I were writing the pilot, I had a job running a pub theatre at a pub called the Old Red Lion. And Ben wandered in one night. With a play that he had written, wanting to put it on. And Rick was there.
Ben had been a year below Rick at Manchester. Yeah, so Ben wandered in.
So Ben wandered in wanting to do his play.
Isn't it about Mussolini or something?
I have no idea. And because he wrote a play every 2 days, as far as I could tell. He was like Ernie Wise. And I said, no, we can't put on your play. We don't actually put on plays. We only do plays that other people have got productions of. And Rick was like, oh, well, Ben's a really good writer. Why don't we get him to do this with us? And so it was the tenor of, you know, everything then was like, yeah, sure, why not? Let's do it. So then Ben became involved.
And he did, in all fairness, bring something to the party.
Yeah. And then we filmed the pilot. And they commissioned.
When was that? Because I
that
remember.
Was winter, because it was so cold.
And we shot it in Holloway, didn't we? And it was, so that in, was the.
And
that was before. That was before we went to. So that was that 1981. That was the winter of 1981.
What I most remember is I, for some reason, I think because there was snow on the ground, I decided that it would be a good idea to wear Wellington boots. And I thought that my toes had frostbite. I was so cold. And we had that scene where Neil was crucifying himself on the outside of the house, and that was so cold.
Yeah. There's that scene. I mean, there's a whole scene at a bus stop, isn't there, with Pauline and Maggie Steed, where is that in the...
When the plane's going to crash.
Yeah, and am I menacing them with an umbrella? Because that was a reference to Yogi Ma. I mean, it's amazingly
really
obscure even then. But if somebody wants to get really deep into it, I'm menacing them with an umbrella, because that's a reference to Georgi Markov, who was poisoned, a Bulgarian dissident who was poisoned with ricin on Waterloo Bridge. But there's a great line where Pauline says, when they're on the top of the bus, what that boy needs is a good wank.
Yes.
You wrote that? Is that you?
I don't know. I remember very pretentiously when he's on.
But they ding. They put a bell.
When Rick's crucified on the front of the house, and he goes, "House, house, house, oh, you are made of stone," which was supposed to be a reference to King Lear, which probably absolutely no one has ever got ever.
But you were amazing, even in the pilot, and then in the. I suppose we can. So they. I remember. So we went. the comic strip went to tour Australia. We went to the Adelaide Festival, didn't we, in March or April 1982. And
when the Falklands War broke.
Then when the Falklands War broke out, exactly, because we were away. We left. Yeah. And you came out, and you and Rick, which while we were all sunning ourselves.
Yeah.
With the Pina Bausch Dance Company. That's another story for another day.
We were locked in the hotel room writing the rest of the series.
Right from the start, I mean, what's still so impressive about the young ones is the creativity of it, the fact that there are no bounds. Well, the one you brilliantly deconstructed. I mean, it was right, really, because I was the first one to be on telly, really. But what I'd just been doing my act, but with the kind of swear words taken out. Whereas what you realised was that what you needed to be on telly was a TV form, which you then deconstructed, as it were.
But I don't know how intentional it was, or whether it was just how can we get everything into this format that we want to get into it. So we got the idea of having the cutaways and being able to go off into sort of sketches.
That was amazing, the original. I mean, you see something like Family Guy uses that, but I mean, this is, 1981, 1982. I mean, it's spectacularly original. And then the bands, we'll do that story later, although I think a lot of people know that, but also, the puppets. I mean, do you think it was partly that you were, because you didn't, what was that, could you tell me about how you didn't know how to get from one scene to another scene?
That I hadn't realised that, you can have a scene in the kitchen and then you can write cut to the bedroom. So I'd think, they're all in the kitchen, so they have to go, we have to do something on the stairs on the way to the bedroom. And so there'd be a scene on the stairs. And so some of it was just, being too literal about getting people from one place to another, and sort of sticking extra things in that you wouldn't, a lot of the good things we did by accident.
Right.
And then in the first series, we learned a lot of things, so we couldn't do them by accident in the second series. So in the second series, it was actually a lot slicker and more professional, but didn't have and had other things, but then lot of the sort of raw edges were gone.
Because
you can't fake that.
No, you can't. No, you can't unknow the things that you know.
No, exactly.
So what was your, I mean, how did it all seem to you, the whole experience? I suppose we could also, the fact that you were very, and still are to some extent, a woman in television comedy.
Well, I would probably answer that differently now than when people asked me then, because then they would say, what's it like to be a woman in comedy? And I'd go, well, I don't know, because I've never been a man in comedy. I'm just a person. But looking back on it, it was appalling, some of the things that happened, that we'd be in a reading the script through the first time and someone would ask me to go and make the teas and stuff.
Right.
And I used to tell them to fuck off.
Yeah.
But they would still, those things happened. There was a story that I told about when we'd done the first series, and if you'd done a series at the BBC, you got invited to the Christmas party, which was a kind of big deal, because all the people that you'd ever seen on television would be there. And you'd go to the sixth floor and have a glass of warm champagne and a canapé. And they sent the invitations out, and I didn't get an invitation. And I complained, and they said, you don't need an invitation because Rick's got a plus one on his invitation, so you can come with him. So I said, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. I want my own invitation. So they sent me an invitation with my plus one.
Then you got your revenge because?
Well, I didn't intend to get my revenge. I just invited our flatmate, the lovely Roland Riveron, who came and got incredibly drunk and got age drunk as well.
Yeah, and he
went into the kitchen, stole some cutlery. I mean, I got a letter from the BBC saying never bring him again.
Really? Because we were trusted as well, because I think they could. They invited us because it was a big deal, the Ellie Christmas party, wasn't it, really? Because, you know, Warren Mitchell was there and the cast of Dad's Army and, you know, Val Dunican. And they hadn't invited any new young comedians since they'd invited the Pythons and they'd turned up in jeans. And I think that they knew that we were more reliable than that because we were comedians, we respected certain aspects, I think, of the tradition, and so we knew. So I didn't wear a dinner jacket, but I did wear a suit and tie and stuff because I thought that was just respectful. So it was you that ruined it for us all. Right? I mean, they still kept inviting us.
I remember being worried though about meeting people that you'd want to take the piss out of in some way, and then you couldn't if you got to know them and became friends with them or found that they were nice as people, you know, that it sort of took your edge off.
Absolutely. It's the eternal problem. So how was the making of people say, was it fun?
It was fun. It was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always frustrated, and in those days, it was very unionized, and you had to stop dead on 10 o'clock when you were filming. And we never ever managed to, we had so much to pack in, and we tried to do as much as possible in the studio because we realized that things on film weren't as funny as things on video. Right. And in those days, when you did outside broadcast, they did it on film, and there's something. Although I think by the end we insisted on doing it on tape.
Yeah, we had an OB scanner, I think, to remember. Yeah.
But I'm not sure we did at the very beginning, like in the
probably
pilot
shot on
and things.
16 mil, yeah.
And there's just something about film which makes everything a bit more beautiful and therefore a bit less funny. And also in terms of the comic timing when you're playing in stuff that you've already filmed, it doesn't work in the same way that performing in front of an audience does. And I think all the performers in the young ones were very much live performers and, you know, who weren't really used to working to a camera, but who responded really well to a studio audience.
And those, I mean, I do remember that those studio recordings. So we would do what they call pre-records when we were on a Thursday. That would be all the stuff like with lions and what have you that we couldn't do.
Yeah, and we'd have done the outside broadcast.
Yeah.
And then occasionally we could record a bit of the dress rehearsal on the studio day. And then we would do the live recording with the audience. And then we would have to finish at 10 or, as always happened, because I used to be in the gallery, Paul would have to ring down to the basement where the VT engineers were and negotiate with them to get an extra 15 minutes.
Right.
So that we could overrun.
Right.
And then we'd usually overrun, but that was it. And then it would, if you hadn't finished, it would just, that was it, cut off. And then when you were editing, because it wasn't digital, you could only do kind of one generation of edits.
Right.
So you couldn't kind of look at an edit that someone had done and go, can you just fiddle with this, this and this, because you would lose quality in it. So there was always stuff that I wasn't happy with or wished we could do again, do another take, re-edit or anything, but it just had to be the way it was. And, you know, and maybe in retrospect that, you know, contributed to the roughness as well.
But those nights as well, that we would then go to the BBC bar, wouldn't we, which was, which is, I've got very fond memories.
Well, I don't, because that's where I used to get groped. That's where you really noticed being a female at the BBC.
Yeah. Well, I can only apologise. But at the time.
For your gender.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the time it seemed very exciting because there'd be, you know, showgirls in there,
In
feather plumage that they'd just done. Well, it was some variety
to be
show.
Fair, they were probably having a worse time than I was.
I'm sure they were. And sometimes if it was some band would be in there, and it all seemed very interesting. Yeah. And then we'd go to that Indian restaurant.
There were two restaurants. There were only two places that were open late at night, and one was that Indian at Shepherd's Bush Green, and the other was the that Chinese restaurant that was towards Holland Park, the Mandarin.
Oh, right. I only remember going to the Indian.
Singapore Mandarin, I think it was called. And it was literally, there wasn't, Westfield wasn't there. There wasn't anything.
There was nothing. Shepherd's dead.
It was a wasteland.
Well, there was that wine bar, wasn't it? Albertine's, which I always say, it was always full of, like, there'd be an older producer.
But it wasn't open late, right?
No. But when you were in there, there was always an older producer and a young PA, female PA, crying. The older producer would say, well, I will, as soon as the kids have left school, I will leave my wife.
Well, also the BBC used to have the theatre on Shepherd's Bush Green where they did Russell Harty and stuff like that.
Yeah, Wogan.
No, not Russell Harty. That was the Greenwood, wasn't it? That was ITV.
Yeah, I think it was, or certainly Wogan.
Or LWT.
I did stuff. I don't think I ever did Wogan, but God, it's a different world, isn't it, really? So you smoking as well, by the way. I see you smoking.
I've fallen back into the habit, but
smoking cigarettes, weed.
You're smoking cigarettes.
I stopped. I haven't really smoked weed all year. I'm doing really well with that, but the cigarettes are very tempting.
I've got a good giving up smoking technique because I used to be a smoker.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But it's, you have to basically realize that you only want the first puff for your hit of nicotine.
Yeah.
The first couple of puffs. So you light a cigarette and you have the couple of puffs you need, and then you cut off the tip with a pair of scissors. And then every time, and then when you next want a cigarette, you have to light the same cigarette. So you basically suddenly, instead of smoking 20, you're smoking 5 a day, but, and they're getting increasingly disgusting. And then when you've got down to only having, you know, a few a day with that method, you think, okay, I'll just go a day and see if I can go a day without having one. And then if you manage to do 3 days, you've cracked the back of the nicotine habit and it's silly to go back. And then with three
weeks, great.
It's out of your system. But you tell yourself that any time you want one, you'll have one.
There you go. The graphic will leave this in. This
is I might keep that in the show. It's a public service.
Well, this podcast is informative.
And, of course, now you can get a vape without any nicotine in it. So in terms of the fiddling around with your hands.
And, yeah, I've got that too. I'm double fisting.
Yeah, he's got all that. Anywho.
Thank you,
Lisa. So I was telling you about the sort of on a show.
No, I was talking about, I was saying that there was an episode of Woman's Hour with Emma Barnett, my secret girlfriend. We won't go into that now. And she was interviewing Jennifer Saunders, and she mentioned, as a kind of breakthrough moment in comedy for women, the scene where in the party where where Rick finds a tampon in somebody's handbag. I presume you wrote that.
Yeah, in fact, that was actually something that had happened to me as a child that I'd found a box of my mother's Tampax and thought that they were a present that someone had given to me, and I'd actually made them into little mice and put faces on them and stuff by the time she found them. So I was always, my favourite comedy was always the comedy of embarrassment.
Yeah.
So, which obviously those characters lent themselves very well to.
Yeah, it's a great scene. I mean, it is in many ways. I loved that episode anyway, really. And I liked that I was friendly with Nicholas Ball, who plays Britain's, voted 2 years running, I think, Britain's sexiest man in The Sun when he played the Detective Hazel.
Which was written by Terry Venables, wasn't
it? Yeah, it's part written.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I know, that's amazing. And I persuaded him to play Professor Jim Morrison, and I don't know why I love that line where he says, "Rick, oh hello, Professor Morrison, how did you get here?" And he just says, "In my car." But it's the way that Nick Ball says "in my car" that I just think that's one of my favourite lines. I don't know why, really. Yeah. But was that in the first? I think that was in the first series, was it?
Was it, or was it interesting or boring?
But I used to, when I was on the kind of book reading circuit. The story I used to tell about that was that somebody had hired, there are all the extras in that, hired from an agency called Real Proper Psychopaths. No, really. Remember, they were terrifying, all the extras in that.
I didn't know they'd come.
And they actually, you can, and if this is again for you, if you watch the recording, you can see me on my hands and knees crawling off the set to get away from the violence. And I think they did actually, because they were supposed to beat up Neil, so they did.
There was the police coming in.
They did attack Nacho quite badly, I think.
We were very disturbed to discover that that the young ones was very popular with policemen when it came out. And it was like, we're so anti-police, and, you know, we've called the
Keith Allen used to berate SPG us. I know, I never minded that.
Touring bands and police.
Yeah.
And school kids.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah.
I never had a problem with that, really. So, yes, all right. So.
Oh, now you were asking me about the process of the recordings. So we'd go in, we'd have a table read for the, you know, with the script. In North Acton rehearsal rooms.
Darling, wasn't that just a
doesn't exist
a dream.
Anymore.
So that's the first time I had what do you call it? What's that thing?
What, food?
Yeah, no, but because it had such, like, because Larry Olivier and that would be rehearsing, Cholos and Cressida in there, as well as, you know, the two Ronnies. The canteen was actually really kind of gourmet quality.
Yeah, it was a lot better than TV Centre.
Eggs Florentine.
Oh, yeah, with spinach.
What's that thing on a muffin with ham and...
Eggs Benedict.
Eggs Benedict. That was the first time I had that. Was at North Acton, not and because the canteen was.
See, I have a horror of egg whites, so I never would have eaten that.
Well, anyway, so we'd have a table read, and
so we'd have a table read at which point we would discover that the script ran over an hour long, and then I would have a sleepless night editing it.
You did that.
Usually me, to try and get it down.
Ben wrote separately, didn't he? He would bring in his...
But no, by then they were all amalgamated, but that's
so
probably why they were so long. Yeah, when we were writing...
Well, you obviously live with Rick, but...
Rick, me and Ben would have a meeting and we would thrash out what we wanted the episode to be and what the plot was and everything about it. And then Rick and I would write an episode and Ben would write an episode and then Rick and I would amalgamate the two episodes, and Ben's tended to be very sort of dialogue heavy and have, you know, good gags in them and things. So we would merge them and then present them as the finished scripts, which we would then read, discover they were ridiculously long and have to cut them. And Paul actually got us an extension so that instead of being half hour episodes, they were 35 minute episodes. Because we just couldn't get them down any further. And then we would rehearse. So that would be the Monday.
Coming to North Acton on the Monday.
And then we'd rehearse, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, go to TV Centre on the... Was it Friday or Saturday we had the recordings?
I think we had the pre-records on the Thursday and then did the... But it might have been Saturday.
Yeah, we had either like 5 or 6 days rehearsal.
Yeah.
At some point during the rehearsal, someone would get an idea and say, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could have a sofa that turned into a coffin? And at which point the call would go out, Iris, get down.
It was just, what's going on at this point? Lisa's got this dog, rescue dog from Spain, who I'm the only man that she loves.
She's
obsessed with me. But then she gets overexcited and tries to bite my face. And that is like every relationship with a woman I've ever had, really, essentially. So anyway, she's over the other side of the room now.
She's looking like she's about to
pounce
or start talking. We'd actually asked for all these things that we thought we wanted, like having 2 week rehearsal periods and not having a studio audience. And when we did it, it turned out it was a really bad idea because you kind of can over rehearse, and you can also, we needed the studio audience for the atmosphere and timing and everything. But
because I've got this another story I used to tell when I was on the dinner circuit, when I was on the book reading circuit, was that my memory is that Rick and Aid drunkenly She's biting me, aren't I? that Rick and I drunkenly said, wrote this line about, quick, let's do this before Elephant Head comes on and starts singing. I forgot about it, but it somehow made its way into the script. And so this company in Glasgow, who I think were about to go bust, were suddenly commissioned to make this Elephant Head.
I have no.
Giant rubber head. It's in the show. Then when it turned up, we're all like, what the fuck is this? Because we'd forgotten that anybody'd ever. And so it had to go in.
I also remember that we had a character who, and we said somebody with a very long nose that we were imagining was a prosthetic. And then they had just cast someone with a really big nose, and like randomly.
I love the BBC in those days.
But it was incredible, wasn't it? We had a sort of 4 or 5 man special effects team.
Yeah.
Led by Dave Barton and Johnny.
Yeah.
And you could say, you know, I want a brick that explodes. I want, you know, a giant eclair that's going to fall from the ceiling. And, you know, it could be in the script, or you could even think of it in the rehearsal process, and they would make it.
Such a wow. I mean, it was a golden age, wasn't it? In-house stuff.
They had a wig department where they made extraordinary wigs and costumes. I mean, it was a sort of centre of excellence in lots of fields other than, you know, just acting and writing and making TV programs.
Yeah, it was truly. And I think, people don't. I think I knew. I mean, I didn't know it was going to end, but I knew that we were. That I really appreciated all that.
Yeah.
I think that depth of support that you got, really.
The expertise and the, you know.
Of course, it's all gone now. All sold off.
It really felt like, I guess, like old Hollywood, that it was a sort of works town, that it, you know, that everyone there was the best in their field and, you know, and knew what they were doing, but also that they were doing original things and that it wasn't just based on, you know, what had been the last successful thing or what, you know, a kind of focus group had told them would be a successful thing to do.
They were really brave. Really,
I mean, there was no way that we would get that on the air now.
No, I think that's one of the questions that was asked, really. You don't think that it would get made today, really?
No, because basically Paul Jackson, who was a junior producer, could go in and say to his head of department, there's this thing I want to do, and they would go, well, it looks like complete, you know, shite to me, but, you know, I trust your judgment, you know, give it a go.
Yeah.
You can't imagine that happening now.
No.
And we had a huge budget, which is what you touched on earlier when you were talking about the bands.
So tell that story then.
Well, just that we realised Paul Jackson told us that we said, oh, we can have all kinds of things. We could have sketches. We could have, you know, music. And he went, oh, well, if you have music, we can be in variety. And if we're in variety, then we've got a much bigger budget than if we're in comedy. And so we came under the variety department. And we had originally it was going to be, you know, lion tamers and sword swallowers and all kinds of things. And I think in the first series we had a lion tamer.
That was a mess, that lion tamer.
And just about, I don't think any of the other variety acts were anything other than bands.
No.
And actually, you know, it fit much better with who we were to have bands anyway in that sort of punk era.
Somebody asked about, how did Motorhead end up getting on the show?
Because Rick particularly loved Motorhead. And actually, I think that.
And you just told, like, that department at the BBC booking or whatever.
Yeah.
Get Motorhead.
Well, and it was series two by then, so it was easier.
So I think I got Madness because I think I knew I might be bigging myself up there, but I think I knew Madness.
And we had your band.
I guess that's right. So I apologise for that.
The first episode we had Nine Below Zero, who I don't think exist anymore.
No, they do. I was at a book festival in Berkhamsted at the weekend, really? And I think they just played it, you know, which, you know, take whatever meaning you want out of that.
And we were friends with Jules Holland, so then, you know, and I'd had the idea, and I think it was in series two, of doing the sort of Bob Dylan, Subterranean Homesick Blues.
Right. I, because somebody has another question is, what were the Damned like? I just remember the Damned, that one of them.
Captain Sensible.
Captain Sensible, but one of the other ones.
That
is,
was the Chinese restaurant we were talking about.
Oh, really?
That maybe he was standing on the table. They were all really well behaved, except Captain Sensible, who sang Happy Talk on the table of the Chinese restaurant.
Had he already had a hit with that? Or
he'd had a hit with it, and the rest of the band didn't like him because he'd had a hit with Happy Talk.
Right. But I can just remember one of them, that his wife worked in the booking office of British Airways.
And
I
remember Dave Vanian?
I can't remember, but just him ringing his wife and, oh, hello, you know, I'm just at work. And I thought, ah, how sweet, you know.
I always tell Andy Oliver, who's now, you know, a kind of national treasure or whatever, that they were the most disruptive band we've ever had.
Was she Rip Rigg and Ponick? Was that Andy Oliver?
That was Andy,
Really, I didn't know that. Yeah. I was Matisse's mum.
Yeah, because Nina Cherry, who was in it as well, for some reason couldn't do
Nina
that
Cherry,
one.
That's right.
No, it was Andy.
Oh, right. They were awful. Yeah, they were so badly beat. Well, I tell that again in other stories, that they're like, oh, all this beer, all this drink's real, let's pinch it. And I'm like, no. Those are props. Yeah. We need them for continuity.
No, I know. That was...
That was Andy Oliver.
Yeah.
I didn't... Well, there's a scoop for your boys and girls, I think. What's she in? Bake Off or MasterChef or something?
Great British Menu, I think. And a lot of other things, yeah.
Yes, they were terrifying, weren't they, really? They were scary.
They were by far the naughtiest of the bands.
Somebody says, what music was it? Oh, that's a line of Rick's as well, isn't it? Is have you got any music? So and there's the music, my braces, here's a Rip, Rig and Panic. Which I think is also a fantastic line.
I just remember in the party when he came in and went, anyone here like the Human League or something? And then meeting them later and going, you know, was that anti-human?
They were quite touchy, weren't they, the Human League? Phil Oakey of the Human League thought we had a feud for years. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware that we had, really. Maybe that's what he was talking about.
Well, also because I
was perplexed when I met him.
I was friends with Heaven 17, who had formerly been the Human League.
There's an interesting documentary I saw about the music scene in Sheffield, where all those bands are from, and it's filmed. It's like filmed on a tram, and so like it's ridiculous, but it's like, so the Human League will get on the tram, travel around for a bit talking about, and then they'll get off, and Heaven 17 will get on, and then they'll talk for a bit, and then they'll get off the tram, and Jarvis Cocker will get on. It's on
BBC
Four.
As the tram is traveling
through
time.
It goes through time as well. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's worth seeking out, boys and girls, if you want.
I guess we must have been going out at the same time as the Tube. Was
that a little bit later,
beginning of Channel 4, wasn't it?
Yeah, did that go out in the first? Because we were always on the Tube, weren't we? I mean, we were always going up to Newcastle.
I feel like it must have. Well, the Young Ones didn't come up. The BBC brought it out to coincide with the launch of Channel 4, didn't they?
Yeah. I think usually you'd be plugging comic strip stuff. Because that's the other idiotic thing about me, is that I was supposed to be in the comic strip and I refused.
Well, you were latterly.
Later on, when I realised my mistake, and luckily they let me in, unlike. Who do you think you are?
really? Did you try and grovel your way back into
I told them. They said, came to me with the first series and said, I'm like, fuck you. And then when I saw how popular it was, I said, oh, well, maybe I'll. They're like, fucking not having you now, you twat.
Really?
Yeah. And also star in a reasonably priced car. I was also sniffy about that. Anyway.
Because it would be nice to know. I mean, I know your dad came from the Isle of Man.
Well,
yeah,
that's what I could pay for. Really wanted them. Anyway, they won't have me now. I'm like so many shows, I'm barred. What were we talking about?
Did you see Dame Judi Dench's the other day?
No, it was
really moving, actually. Really? Yeah.
Anyway, we're not here, so she can plug her own fucking podcast. I know Saul Williams is on that as well. So what were we talking about? Oh yeah, we used to do the Tube. Oh yeah, I said I wouldn't be in the comic strip because I was loyal to the Young Ones. Like I didn't think we should be both on BBC Two and Channel 4 at the same time, even though everybody else who was in the fucking Young Ones was in the comic strip as well. So I was being ludicrously loyal. You were
being more loyal than
the people who were actually...
Showing loyalty that hadn't even been asked
for. No, or was entirely inappropriate. And, of course, that left the door open for Robbie Coltrane because he got to play all the fat bloke parts.
Why?
Well, that's my reading of it. There is the awful... Although I don't know whether we want to...
He was in the younger ones as well. Because the reason...
Not as much. But that, and that's the other thing.
Because that came from Kevin Turvey. That's where Robbie came from because Kevin Turvey was in a kick-up. The 80s, which was made in Scotland by Colin Gilbert and Sean Hardy of Not the 9 o'clock News, and Robbie was in that, which is where we met.
And there is also the fact, the mic question, which is, we touched on this when we did the reunion. That was supposed to be Peter Richardson. Did we?
I don't know if we talked about it then, but it was. I mean, when it was written for Peter Richardson, and then. Peter and Paul Jackson didn't see eye to eye.
They certainly didn't.
So it was mutually decided that that Peter wouldn't play Mike. And then I think Keith Allen was mooted briefly, and he had also burnt his bridges rather successfully with Paul Jackson and the BBC. So then we auditioned. For it.
And I think
very nearly cast Timothy Spall.
Really?
Who did an absolutely brilliant reading, but visually his face was too similar to Nigel's.
Right.
The sort of hangdog look. So that.
I think it was good that there wasn't another comic. I think Chris Ryan was actually a good balance, I think, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing in retrospect that we didn't think, oh, why don't we have a woman or something like that?
Yeah. Most of the time.
Yeah, a person of colour.
Yeah. Young ones' questions. Let's see if. I'll go through them quickly. Was an old ones, you know, ever planned? No, not really.
I always had the idea of doing the middle-aged ones.
Really?
Maybe as a sort of one-off for Comic Relief or something like that. You know, I thought, and I had this idea that, you know, they'd all gone into, you know, Neil would have cut his hair and be wearing a suit and, you know, Vivian would be on his, you know, third marriage and sort of work in a hospital and, you know, still drink too much, but, you know.
Yeah.
Just the disappointment, really, of the usual disappointment of most people's lives and, you know, what they think they're going to do when they're 18, 19, 20 and what they end up.
I think it's better left as it. I think we should have done a third series, I think, in a Christmas special.
Yeah, well, the only reason why we didn't do a third series in a Christmas special is because Rick had this sort of romantic notion that we were Fawlty Towers and that we had to, you know, do two series and get out and, you know, kind of keep it as a sort of in amber, you know, as a sort of before we went too far. But I think we had a lot more we could have done with it.
Yeah, I think we finished it too early, really.
You know, and given that we'd killed them all in the pilot, we did have, you know, the opportunity to come back. It wasn't like we were tied to hyper-realism or anything.
No. Who was the fifth housemate?
Everyone always thinks that's me.
Mm.
And I might start pretending that it was me, but I didn't have an equity contract, so I couldn't do it. But basically the idea was that the house they lived in was a student house, and at some unspecified point in time, there had been a party there, and someone had, you know, just never left. So that you had occasional subliminal glances of a woman with long dark hair who just sort of sat in the corridor, and you just might get a tiny glimpse.
I never noticed she was there.
Did you really?
I never knew. It's like, what fifth? I never knew. I'm a bit snooty. I never talked to her. Did we? Who was she? Who played the part?
An extra.
All right. Who chose the bands?
I would say Rick and me, probably. But I don't. I mean, yeah.
What's your favourite line from the series?
I quite like the rant about pig intelligence.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
And I used to laugh a lot at your the monologue that you did about the Peak Freen's Trotsky assortment.
Oh, right, yes,
but that doesn't really count because it's your line, not mine.
Yeah, well, no.
So did you not write any of Alexei's stuff?
No. He got additional material credit and, I mean, yes, I did write some of his stuff when he was a character.
Because all that Brian, I didn't write any of Brian Damage. Yeah. Instance, that's all you.
Or the vampire.
Or the vampire, yeah, Harry the Bastard, yeah.
Well, or Tommy Bilofsky.
Or Tommy, turns out I didn't write anything at all.
Yes, exactly. We wrote most of it. It's just when he went into a little routine.
Yeah. So it was not written. So the bits where I'm, yeah, well, probably couldn't do that anymore. When I'm going, hello, clocks and all that, that's me.
That's you just ad-libbing.
Yeah.
What about when you voiced the cat doing stand-up?
I didn't do that. I didn't do that. For some reason, I wasn't asked to do any of the voices.
What cat's doing stand-up?
What cats?
No, there was the puppet cat. You know, remember when the cat, and it goes into a little stand-up routine about peas?
It wasn't me. I didn't do that.
I like peas, 5 peas, 10 peas, 20 peas.
Yeah.
I don't know who did that. Yeah. It wasn't me.
It sounds like you.
I know Aid was SPG the hamster.
Yeah.
I had a hamster when I was... In my student house, I had a hamster and named it Special Patrol Group.
Aww.
And it's really sad. It died after a house party. Some asshole put drugs in its water bottle as a funny joke, quote unquote. Mm. And obviously its bloody heart exploded or something. It was dead the next day. It was heartbreaking. But God.
Literally.
Pretty... I don't want to say a young one's way to go out, but there wasn't really many drug references in the young ones.
No.
But
no, that's true. They weren't very druggy, were they?
Yeah, what's up there?
No, I mean, presumably Neil. I can't remember it. Really,
there was a bit with someone at the party, I think, or the one of the people doing one of the monologues of I'm 16... I can join the army, you know.
And there was also, you said about how we used all our friends, or all your friends anyway.
Rick Aid and Ben had been at Manchester Drama Department and had lots of friends who, you know, who were actors or wanted to be actors. It was a kind of jobs for the boys situation. And we always, you know, and then when Dawn and Jennifer came to the comic strip and everything, it was, you know, how do we get everybody in that we know, you know.
Yeah, but that was nice, I thought. Yeah. I know it's a bit elitist in a way, but I think having all your mates in it. So I got Professor Jim, I got Nick Ball, I think I got Madness.
It was obviously very exciting when Terry Jones agreed to do it as well, because they were heroes.
Yes. Who else? Well, Arnold Brown was it. Tony, do you remember Tony Allen? It took months of negotiations before he could agree something that would fit with his anarchist principles.
And Jim Barclay.
Did he have...
He was the policeman.
He was the policeman, yes, in a line that is
and
now very
Andy
much
Latour.
Andy Latour, yeah, from
and
the old alternative.
Pauline Melville, who
Pauline was in it twice.
Maggie Steed.
Pauline was Adrian's mum.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was nice, that, though, I thought, really. Linda was in the audience for all of the recordings and got a certificate.
You can hear Rick... Male's brother Ant has a very distinctive laugh, and I can still hear him. Yeah.
And Lenny was in. Lenny was in the episode. Lenny policeman, wasn't he? Hey, not policeman, postman.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, I said because he's got to hit the moustache. He said, "Give him a uniform," and they
and
said,
they think they're hit.
Yeah, and they think they're hit. That's brilliant. Yeah. That's so funny.
Oh, it's nice to kind of. Yeah. When that's the other thing is I haven't watched them for such a long time.
Yeah.
Is I probably maybe I would enjoy them more now than at the time when all you see is you know the things that you wish had come out better or you know someone saying a line slightly wrong.
Yeah.
But that that was the other nice thing about the people that were in it is that they would enhance it with their performances.
Yes. Yes. Definitely. Oh, the Oblivion Boys as well, Mark and Steve Frost. See, that's one of my favourite lines, but just, I don't know, it's maybe one of their lines, I'm not sure, but, you know, that one, I really pissed my girlfriend off. I said something awful about the Pope. And Mark Harden says, well, you know she's a Catholic. And he says, I knew she was. Yeah, I didn't know the Pope was.
I feel like that.
I mean, that's a great
gag. I feel like it's an old gag.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned you might want to do a second episode of this one day. But maybe instead, or as well as, there's a very popular YouTube format is watching back shows people have made and doing kind of a commentary or a reaction. Maybe we could get together and watch some episodes. And
that's what we were kind of going to do on live.
Well, let's say if everybody enjoys this and they flock back.
Yeah. If you get more viewers than you did on your previous podcast. Yeah,
if we quadruple the listeners.
So it's up to you, listeners.
Yeah, it's up to you, people. We'll do one's part two.
Hello, Talal here from the Alexis L podcast. And just a really quick interruption, just to remind you that if you are loving the show and all the stuff that we put out on YouTube, there's a really great way that you can support us financially and help pay the bills and keep the wheels a-turning. And that's by heading to patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast. That's right. You can go over to patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast and select a monthly donation bracket and pop us some cash, show us your love, and help keep this machine running. And I'll put a link to that site in the podcast description. All right, that's all I got to say. Thank you. patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast. Bye.
Next time, I think we'll either go back to, go back to our A to Z of communism, do Engels, or I'll just go back to calling Keir Starmer a country. But also, we should also cover me and you, Lisa.
Why an A to Z? Why are you up to E?
Because we've done A, B, C, and D.
Who were A, B, C?
Well, A, I can't remember. A was anarchism with Professor.
Oh, okay. So you're not doing Paul people Preston. For all of them.
No, no. B and C was Bolshevism and Communism with Professor Tony Collins. D was Democratic Socialism with a guy you may have heard of called Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm trying to actually manage.
Thought we said that wasn't part of the A to Z, the JC episode.
No, I've changed my mind.
What? I have to retro. Shall I go change the title of the episode?
If you want.
Okay. No, well,
you could have him for C as Corbyn. Yeah. J as Jeremy. Yeah, just have him on every other week.
Yeah. But the other thing we should discuss is that me and Lisa are, Lisa more than me really, are practitioners of the ancient Chinese art of martial art of Kung Fu. And our group is also runs by a kind of system of filial piety, Confucian filial piety. So Lisa is actually, she's more senior than me. She's my older sister.
I know. Alexei has to bow to me sometimes.
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
Isn't that weird? I do. Thank you. Thank you, Sifu.
It's
Well, you recruited me. Tiger Crane Kung Fu.
And you do, we do, Kung Fu, as everyone knows, means hard work. And it's the Chinese, people always think, get confused with karate and think that it's a made up thing, but karate is Japanese and means open hand, and Kung Fu is Chinese. Well,
Kung Fu came first.
Yes. And there are lots of we're of the five ancestor styles. White Crane is the last and most evolved and is a woman style.
Yes, that's our foundation myth, as it was developed. Like, yes. Wing Chun is devised by a woman, yeah.
Yeah, Fang Qing Yang.
That's good.
And we do a blend of tiger and crane, which we call Tiger Crane Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Under our teacher, David Courtney Jones.
Yeah.
And, you do it a lot now, don't you? Like three times a week, would you say?
Yes.
Three, four times a week?
Yeah, yeah.
And training on Sundays?
I mostly do the soft style, which is a kind of Tai Chi, but a martial art. I do weapons.
Yeah. You do staff, broadsword. Did you do any of the other weapons? Did you do the teepee when we had the...
No, I still haven't really graduated. And Talal also, have you been going to your classes, Talal?
Yes,
What do you do?
I do Shaolin Kung Fu. It's got a Chinese name as well, which I can't.
It's good. It's very. It's good. You can do high kicks and stuff.
Think of right now. Yeah, my Sifu says I've got very good legs.
Have you ever thought of leaving and coming to our club?
in West London.
Yeah, I'm in West London. I'd love to come for a visit, see what it's like. You do it on Wednesdays, right?
We do Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays. And then there's also a Thursday class and a Tuesday on Zoom.
My class is Mondays and Tuesdays, but I only do Mondays because I stream my other show, Vicky's World, the Dungeons and Dragons podcast, on Tuesdays.
But there can't be many podcasts where everybody involved could fuck you up.
That's right.
Maybe some of them white supremacist ones, I suppose.
The problem is, I've never had to, I mean, I say the problem is, I guess it's a good thing, but I've never had to use it in real life. And part of me
same.
Often kind of yearns for a moment when I can try it out, but at the same time.
But I like to think it's not just the violent thing that you have to use in real life, but in general the kind of elegance and composure and movement is stuff we'd use every day. You know, like when I make a cup of tea, I try to do it with precision and concentration and
yes, it also teaches you how to train and learn, doesn't it? That's you know, it teaches you about practice and hard work and perseverance and being fit for purpose.
But also I think that knowing Kung Fu means that this may prove to be an illusion, but people, you just don't give up the victim vibe.
Yeah.
You just, wherever you go, you know, within limits.
You carry yourself.
You don't look like a victim, really. So nobody is inclined to pick on you. Really.
Well, it's self-defense, isn't it? So one of the ways to defend yourself is to look like the sort of person that shouldn't be attacked.
Yeah.
That's true. In almost every routine or sequence we learn begins with someone throwing a punch at you. It's very rarely begins with you attacking.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it begins with a block or a dodge of sorts. And so it's not something you intend to go out there. And there was a bully at my school who did taekwondo. And he was the opposite. He used to use it as a bullying thing and fucking intimidate and scare the shit out of me.
Taekwondo is a weird one, isn't it? Because it's become a sport. So it's sort of lost a lot of the artistry, I think. And it's just a lot of kicking.
Yeah.
It looked terrible in the Olympics. I thought it looked just awful.
So many pads as well. Kind of like takes away the whole.
We have a lot of hand movements as well as kicking.
Yeah.
You know, like I think the northern styles tend to do more kicking than we do.
Yeah.
We're southern style.
Yeah, we're from Yongchun.
Which is a a small town of like 2 million people. That's famous for martial arts and vinegar.
That's right.
I love it. I've been doing it 2 years now. And to be honest, like there are people in my class who are much more, not just dedicated, but able to. They work 9 to 5s, whereas a lot of the time in the evenings, I just can't go. So I don't think I'm on the level of you two. I've been doing it 2 years and only graded once. I'm on a yellow belt, but I really enjoy it.
In our club, we don't change the colours of, but we only have, once you've graded, you have, if you do the soft style, the Swan Young, you get a yellow belt. If you do the hard style Kung Fu, you get a maroon belt. If you're an instructor, you have a blue belt. If you're a child, you have a green belt, and that's it. Because the idea being that you don't want to advertise to your opponent what level you're at.
That's great. I wish they did that in mine. Because I've been going longer than so many people, but they've all got more belts than me. But we're kind of equal levels, but I just...
Well, the other reason is that you're competing against yourself and... in terms of getting better, and you know, and everyone has their own. You know, I'm a lot older than a lot of people in the class, and won't ever be able to do some of the things they do. But on the other hand, you know, I've got, you know, I'm very bendy, and you know, and I've got things that I can do. And I think that if you sort of try and you know, if everyone has different colors of belts and you're trying to grade just to get the next color of belt, then that's slightly sort of, it becomes about the sort of instant gratification of the new color of belt rather than improving. But I have competed in China.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But terrifying, but fun. And I took my son, who's ginger, and it was like, you know, being with a K-pop band or something. We had to get security on the second day, you know, because hordes of people arrived at the hotel to see him and have their photo taken with the ginger.
My God.
You can probably hear the ginger dog.
The dog's trying to bite my face again, so it's probably a good time to stop. Thank you, everybody. If you enjoyed that Young Ones Kung Fu episode, we can always do another one. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stop biting me.
Iris, get down.
Ow.
Iris.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.